aside, the procedures described by U.S. will not prevent Mr. Assange from finding a way to commit suicide, said barrister. And for this reason, I have decided extradition would be oppressive by reason of mental harm, and I order his discharge. As Shadow Proof managing editor Kevin Costola, who has been covering the extradition case from its inception, put it, the United States government mass incarceration system just lost them their case against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Lawyers for the U.S. government, which in 2019 charged Assange with 17 counts of violating the Espionage Act, said they will appeal barrister's decision as Assange attorneys fight for his release on bail. If extradited to U.S., Assange, whose health has declined precipitously in recent months due to conditions that physicians have condemned as torture, would face up to 175 years in a maximum security prison. The aggressive effort by U.S. authorities to extradite and punish Assange for publishing classified documents that exposed American war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan has been decried as a major threat to press freedoms everywhere, given that journalists regularly obtain and report on secret materials. While raising alarm over her dismissal of press freedom concerns, human rights groups, organizations welcomed barrister's ruling against extradition as an important step in protecting Assange and other journalists around the world. Today's ruling is a huge sigh of relief for anyone who cares about press freedom, Trevor Tim, executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, said in a statement. While the judge's opinion contains many worrying assertions that disregard journalists' rights, her rejection of the Trump administration's extradition request means the U.S. government likely won't be able to obtain any precedent that would criminalize common news gathering and publishing practices, and that is a very good thing. After joining others in applauding the judge's decision to reject the U.S. extradition request, Rebecca Vincent of Reporters Without Borders said she has serious concerns about the substance of the judgment. We disagree with the judge's assessment that this case is not politically motivated, that it's not about free speech, said Vincent. We continue to believe that Mr. Assange was targeted for his contributions to journalism, and until the underlying issues here are addressed, other sources, journalists, and publishers remain at risk. In a column for The Guardian on Monday, January 4th, Owen Jones wrote that it is not to critic the soundness of barrister's legal judgment to argue that this was the right decision, but for the wrong reason. That a British court has ruled that the U.S. prison system is too barbaric to guarantee the safety of Assange tells its own story, Jones added. But this is about something much bigger than Assange. It's about journalism, the free press, and most importantly of all, the ability to expose atrocities committed by the world's last remaining superpower. John Rees of the UK Don't Extradite Assange campaign said on Monday, January 4th, that it's an incredible judgment, noting that 95% of this judge's remarks supported the prosecution. She said there is no public interest defense, there is no journalistic defense, there is no political opinion defense, said Rees. The one fact that swayed her into refusing the extradition was that the U.S. prison system is so brutal that it would increase the risk of suicide, and she wasn't willing to put him into an oppressive prison system. Noting that the U.S. will appeal, Reese argued Monday's ruling marks the beginning of the fight, not the end of the fight. But it's a terrific day, Reese added, and if the bail application, which they're discussing inside the court right at this moment, goes through and Julian walks free, that will be a terrific watershed in this case. Niels Muznik, Amnesty International Europe director, said in a statement on Monday, January 4th, that we welcome the fact that Julian Assange will not be sent to the United States and that the court acknowledged that due to his health concerns, he would be at risk of ill treatment in the U.S. prison system. But the charges against him should never have been brought in the first place, added Muznik. The fact that the ruling is correct and saves Assange from extradition does not absolve the UK from having engaged in this politically motivated process at the behest of the United States of America and putting media freedom and freedom of expression on trial. It has set a terrible precedent for which the US is responsible and the UK government is complicit. Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, Deputy Executive Director Robert Mahoney echoed Muznik, saying in a statement that the U.S. government's decision to charge the WikiLeaks founder set a harmful legal precedent for the prosecution of journalists around the world simply for interacting with their sources. We urge the U.S. Department of Justice to refrain from further pursuing extradition through appeals and to drop all charges against Assange.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the things that he did at that time for this revolution, if today we can say, like, if Iran has the constitution today, it's because of the hard working of Shahid Beheshti, the dedication that he had on this work.
This is a natural principle, that people are affected by the rulers.
One thing very obvious about his character that made him more influential was his management skills. Not only management skills, but in the more modern sense of it, leadership qualities. He was truly a leader. And when it came to him actually leading the whole group of scholars who were working on the Iranian constitution, you can see the high capability of this person.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear brothers and sisters, dear Muslims all across the world. I'm Atta, the host of the program, The Teacher. The Teacher is mainly concerned with the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and jurists. And with me in the studio are two experts to explain on such people, on one of the prominent outstanding Shia scholars and philosophers of contemporary Iran, the late Shahid Ayatollah Beheshti. With me in the studio are Dr. Murtaza Razazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Dr. Razazadeh, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Glad to be here.
Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti, mainly known as Ayatollah Beheshti, is the person with whom we are mainly concerned. He is believed to be maybe one of the most contemporary intellectual philosopher of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, who had a great role in writing the constitution of the Islamic Revolution. He was also the head of the, we can say, judicial or judiciary power until he got martyred in a bomb attack at the very early beginning of the Islamic Revolution of Iran by MEK, Mujahideen Khaq, on that time. What is known about Ayatollah Beheshti is that everybody considers him, although he was a cleric and he had clerical role, but university and Hauza, an Islamic seminary, he was welcomed very much, and he had studied in both, and internationally speaking, he was also very much famous and very much welcome. He knew Arabic and also English language. He had videos in which he speaks in English very fluently. And all in all, Ayatollah Beheshti was really, we can say, a mastermind regarding the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, as a non-Iranian, what do you know about Shahid Beheshti, and how did you become familiar with him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, as a non-Iranian, how I know Shahid Beheshti and yes. How do I get familiar, it is only because of the revolution.
Okay.
The Islamic Revolution, that today we know about these important people and personalities, and obviously the revolution itself, because it was an Islamic and it was a revolution that shaken the whole world and that showed us the real Islam in it. Obviously, the main, the core person was Imam Khomeini.
That's right.
But all those people who were related to Imam Khomeini and who were working with Imam Khomeini were also important.
That's right.
Especially when we see after the revolution, Imam Khomeini appoints him as the head of
judiciary power. That's right.
So this is it shows that he was someone who is very important in the eyes of Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
And obviously, people sometimes they don't know about the personalities.
Yes.
If I talk about him, obviously, about his personal, you can say, life.
Yes.
What I found about him is, and it was interesting for me, that Shahid Beheshti, from his mother's side,
yes,
he is related to Imam Musa Sadr and Shahid Muhammad Baqir Sadr.
Okay.
Basically, their grandfather, he had three kids. From one of them, their descendants goes to the, like, reaches to the Shahid Baqir Sadr.
That's right.
The other son's descendant reaches to Imam Musa Sadr.
Okay.
And I think from the third son, it goes towards the, obviously, Shahid Beheshti.
Mm-hmm.
So he is related to a scholarly family, we can say. And this thing makes us to think, like it forces us to think that obviously in Islam, when we see such people who are like the big scholars or the names in the history, their descendants also had a big name.
That's right.
And obviously it's because of the training or tarbiyah, or, you know, before they used to say like the generations, they should follow their forefathers in the ethics or the culture and all those.
That's right.
So this is one of the points which I found about him in the history.
That's right.
And it was interesting for me. Overall, obviously, being an outsider, non-Iranian, what he has done for Iran, and especially after his martyrdom, that there were 72 people who were who got killed.
That the number is not clear, but yes. Symbolically but still, speaking, yes.
But still, for me, being an outsider, when I look at the Islamic Revolution's system, that if I want to suppose or assume that if in a parliament the bombing is going to happen,
that's right,
and all the people who are the basically the representatives of the people,
okay,
they all are killed in that bombing,
yes,
that country
has
technically
yes,
should shut down basically.
Yeah. Very great people, that's right.
Yes, very great
not
people.
Not only this bombing,
the active people at that time, but still we can see how this, how the Iranians, for example, at that time, or the revolutionaries, how they basically came up with all these crises and how they dealt with these crises.
This was because of the main pillar of the Islamic Revolution, who was Imam Khomeini. Thank you very much. Up to now, I will get more to details. But Dr. Reza Zadeh, you as a scholar, as a cleric, you know, what did you learn from the life of Shahid Beheshti? How do you know him? How did you find him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that very famous sentence that Imam Khomeini said about Shahid Beheshti? He described him as a nation.
That's right.
Actually, maybe, I mean, obviously, inspired by that verse of the Quran where God the Almighty talks about the Prophet Abraham, that he says, "Inna Ibrahim kana ummatan."
That's right.
Indeed, Abraham was a nation all by himself, obedient to Allah. But the term nation being used for just one person is a really important point. The most important point about this very term that was used by Imam Khomeini is the connotation that it has, and it talks about the comprehensiveness of the character of Shahid Beheshti. And when we look at his character, we really find him a very comprehensive, multidimensional person, and that is like many other influential people in the history. One thing that makes them very lasting and very influential is that they have very different aspects of their character,
right,
and in all of those different aspects they are very successful,
multidimensional
people.
Character, that's right.
For example, Shahid Beheshti, he was definitely a faqih, a mujtahid in Islamic jurisprudence, so he was an expert, he was a philosopher, at the same time he was a politician, and he was very much familiar with the economy, sociology, and he was a public speaker. So we come to know that when it comes to knowledge, he was a very knowledgeable person and a great scholar. And because he was also head of the Islamic Center of Hamburg, and he lived in Germany for several years, he was very familiar with the modern schools of thoughts. And that gave him another important aspect in his expertise, actually. And in addition to this aspect, when it comes to his personal character, we see some very important things that if it was not for those, for these important factors, just being knowledgeable is not enough.
That's right.
For example, he was really a brave person. He was a pious person.
That's
and
right.
At the same time, he was a very moderate person.
That's right.
He was not an extremist in any of his ideas.
This is very important.
So all of these things, you know, knowledge, bravery, piety, moderation, and also being trained by some of the greatest mentors and teachers and scholars like Allama Tabatabai and Ayatollah Burujerdi and Imam Khomeini, being actually trained under their supervision, had made a very comprehensive character from Shahid Beheshti that made him such an influential and impressive person in our history.
And what is great about these personalities at the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, it seems that the mere occurrence of this revolution was a chance or an opportunity for these great people to be known more, something which was maybe not done before the Islamic Revolution. This is the first thing. And the second one is that Shahid Beheshti was really an orator, a speaker, a lecturer. Yes. You know that lecturing is a specific field. Nowadays, they have different courses and classes. But for a Rouhani from the Islamic Hausa, such a speaking and such being fluent on different topics, the question and answer sessions that he held with the students and also the non-believers in the Islamic Revolution on that time and answering their questions in a very scholarly way, this made a very intellectual, we can say, face out of Shahid Beheshti. But it was not tolerable for the enemy, Said Mohsen, was it? Because they assassinated him, they killed him.
Obviously, everyone who tries to talk logically, this is not bearable for the enemies. That's right. Can see, like, even in today's world, if I can give you the example, that we have recently seen, like, the American authorities, they have put sanction on one of the universities of Iran.
That's right.
Now, putting a sanction on the university, it's like
it's
you're taking
one,
back to the Middle
so
Age.
Many, that's right.
Yes, you're taking back the people to the Middle Age, where the people were like the authorities were against the sciences and education.
That's right.
So obviously, anyone who talks logically, who gives the proof, and who with his speeches tries to explain him being on the right path.
That's right.
And what is right and what is wrong. Obviously, because these enemies and because these enemies do not have any answer for that, and they cannot obviously, you can say, have a dialogue or answer back
That's
to
right.
what they are saying. So the last option is just to assassinate the person, so that he do not more talks or
That's
he
right.
do not more proves that we are wrong.
Okay.
And that's the last option, we can say, for the enemies.
That's
so
right.
even these assassins also shows that the person who's been assassinated by the enemies was on the right path.
Okay.
Because if he wasn't, why they basically stopped him, like, or why they shut his mouth by killing him?
That's right.
This shouldn't
this
be
was,
the way.
Yeah, this shouldn't be. And he was famous for being here and there, you know, on different occasions and different... And he was called also Mazloom by Imam Khomeini after his death.
He was called, yes, Mazloom. Yes. Mazloom, it means like the people, they did not realize his status.
His status, that's right.
What kind of person he was, what kind of great person he was,
okay.
they did not realize in his life. They couldn't benefit from him the way they should.
That's right.
And after his martyrdom, that's why Imam said, like, he was Mazloom. He was Mazloom in this sense. That if they could benefit from his presence when he was
yes.
present,
yes.
so they couldn't do that. And obviously, the contributions that we see, even within that time after the revolution, the way he basically write the constitution of Iran,
yes.
especially the economical part,
yes.
and the things that he did at that time for this revolution,
That's
if
right.
today we can say, like, if Iran has the constitution today, it's because of the hard working of Shahid Beheshti.
Yes, one of the great men of the
emphasis
team. That's right.
And the hard working that he had, the dedication that he had on this work,
That's right.
so that this new revolution could have the constitution. So these are not the small things.
Especially being the justice chief
yes.
of Iran, you know, and being in the head of the one of the, I think, most difficult positions, you know, in the Islamic. Because when it is Islamic on that time, it would become more difficult because you have to rule according to the justice of Islam, according to everything, and the ethics of Islam, then it becomes very much difficult. So it seems that he had this spirit of justice in himself that was selected as the Chief Justice. Thank you, my Said Mohsen. Dr. Zaza, is there anything missed?
One thing very obvious about his character that made him more influential was his management skills. Not only management skills, but in the more modern sense of it, leadership qualities. He was
okay.
truly a leader. And when it came to him actually leading the whole group of scholars who were working on the Iranian constitution, when you look at those sessions, there are video recordings of
yes.
those. You can see the high capability of this person actually leading that high-ranking group of scholars and managing it in the best possible way. Mm-hmm. It's mind-blowing that actually he was actually a genius, and these different aspects that I talked about made him so powerful and so influential. And at the end of the day, unfortunately, the enemies could not tolerate him and assassinated him.
That's why it was tier 7th, on, in fact, it is 28th of June 1981, when a bomb exploded during a party conference, and Shahid Beheshti with the other members of the party were martyred and were assassinated. And this was not the first one and was not the last one of the assassinations. But what made him, we can say, I think Shahid Beheshti, he had not that much chance or time to be more in more interaction with the people. It was at the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, but if we did not miss him, for sure he could be the source of many benefits for both the university and the Hausa and the people of Iran. May Allah bless his soul and may he rest in peace, inshallah. Dr. Zazaev, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, thank you very much too. We will get more to the thoughts and works of Shahid Beheshti with playing audio files of him and discussing them in our upcoming session of the program, The Teacher. Dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode. You can visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners, and let us start the day by pondering on words of wisdom from the Prophet's elder grandson and second infallible heir, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace be upon him. Glory is to give in loss and forgive the sin, while chivalry is to safeguard the religion, promote the personality, be lenient, sustain in doing favors, fulfill the rights, and behave amicably with people.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Does have time to Muslim extremists? I don't know.
Israeli supply chains and major industries are under cyber attack. Israel seems to be under a second wave of cyber attacks since November. The latest one is ongoing and began in late December. Over the past 2 months, several Israeli firms have been targeted with a ransomware variant called Pay2Key. Pay2Key is a relatively new ransomware variant first spotted in November by Checkpoint Research, an American-Israeli multinational provider of software. Now, security firm ClearSky says the crypto-locking malware is linked to Foxkitten. The Israeli-based ClearSky cybersecurity firm estimates, with medium to high confidence, that Pay2Key is a new operation conducted by Foxkitten, an Iranian APT group that began a new wave of attacks in November to December 2020 that entailed dozens of Israeli companies. The hacking group published documents related to firms using the US-based cybersecurity firm Portnox's services. These companies included Bezek, Elbit, El Al, the Clalit health provider, and dozens of other firms and companies, according to the Ynet news site. At least 80 business and corporations of in the highest echelons of industry, including military, cybersecurity, airlines, media, and others. The hackers, according to Israeli media, successfully hacked into Israel's regime-owned Israel Aerospace Industries, which is an Israeli military contractor. The attack also hit Amital Data, which provides its Unifreight logistics software, and at least 40 of its clients. Another target was Habana Labs, which produces processors and works under the US-based Intel company, a Dow Jones-listed public semiconductor giant. The firms are some of Israel's most prominent companies. Pay2Key said it seized almost 1 terabyte of data and has published just 3 gigabytes of it. The documents it released included a 15-page report from 2018 that detailed weaknesses at Elbit, a major Israeli defense company, according to the Walla news site. Israel's Portnox Networks, a computers and cybersecurity firm, was also hit hard. Portnox said in response to reports of the attack, several hours ago, it was published that our internal servers may have been breached by a group known as Pay2Key. We are currently conducting an intensive investigation in order to understand the scope of the event. Then in November 2020, the first wave of the attack on Israel began. That's when hackers began leaking information via Telegram and dark web site. This is known as the first wave of attacks. Then this month, the second one started. Multiple companies, including supply chain attacks and leaks via Twitter. This is the fifth cyber attack on Israel during 2020, including one that targeted its water infrastructure in April. In April 2020, a cyber attack targeted agricultural water pumps in northern Israel, while the other struck infrastructure in the center of Israel, according to the British Financial Times paper. The Pay2Key hacker group usually asks for payments of 7 to 9 bitcoins or $189,000 to $243,000. According to cybersecurity researchers, the ransomware is sophisticated and the first of its kind with no overlaps with other known ransomware strains. Apparently, it has been created from scratch, and it is currently unclear who developed the ransomware and why they are targeting only Israeli companies. But this is all ironic, as Israel has always bragged about being one of the global leaders in cyber weapons. In fact, the Israeli regime itself has even eased rules on cyber weapons exports despite criticism.
What not to do is to get in the way of the business side of it. Now, it's impossible not to regulate somewhat, but my principal role has been not to over-regulate. And guess what? The minute this industry begins to percolate and grow and overflow, then the demands for regulating it, as you would regulate a weapons industry, abound. But I think we have to take the risk, and it's a considerable risk, of regulating less in order to grow more. And that's the decision that I have taken and that Israel has taken.
But that was a bunch of nonsense. Israeli companies who have military ties have spied on many journalists and human rights advocates. Their technology has even been used by the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, for example, to target and kill dissidents. According to American whistleblower, living in exile, former National Security Agency NSA, contractor Edward Snowden and Israeli cyber malware firm was enabled the murder of Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey. Snowden, who is currently living in Russia after he leaked secret documents about U.S. telephone and internet surveillance in 2013, explains how the company works.
They go by the name of the NSO. And it works like this. They send you a time-sensitive text message, and it's got a link in it. It's something that you have that, you know, human impulse. You see it, you go, oh, goodness, I need to check that and see what's going on with this. As soon as you click the link, and everybody clicks the link because they can try this 100 different times in 100 different ways, always from a different number, your phone now belongs to whoever sent you that message. Everything in the entire history of your phone, they can immediately copy. Everything that happens on your phone from that day forward, every place you go, everyone you call, everything you read, every photo you take, every audio note that's been on that, or actually because they can turn the microphone on remotely.
By 2018, Israel's NSO Group spyware company's Pegasus software was being used in 45 countries, according to Citizen Lab, targeting activists in Bahrain, Kazakhstan, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Mexico. In 2019, the US-based social media company Facebook sued Israeli cyber surveillance firm NSO Group, saying it hacked over 1,400 users of its messaging platform WhatsApp earlier that year. The hacking spree targeted journalists, diplomats, human rights activists, political dissidents, senior government officials, and others, Facebook said in its lawsuit.
So these softwares that NSO is marketing as tools to prevent terror and crime are used against human rights defenders and lawyers and doctors and members of parliament. We are not criminals and we are not terrorists. And when the Ministry of Defense in Israel allows this to happen, it endangers millions of people around the world.
But when Israel is hacked, it cries wolf and almost always blames Iran. In this latest attack, their Israeli media have pointed the finger at Iran. Of course, this isn't the first time, and such accusations have also been instigated from the top. But the latest hack attack on Israel has left Israeli cybersecurity firms flabbergasted and several industries in a mess. OP Innovate CEO Omer Pinsker, who led the research, and Shay Pinsker are aiding a number of Israeli firms as part of their response teams, according to Israel's Haaretz newspaper. There you have it. Israel, an entity that brags about its cyber criminal activity but can't protect its own infrastructure in the face of a group of hackers that it can't even identify.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Salamun Alaikum. So welcome to this program, today's special. from IRIB English Radio. On today's special, we're going to speak about conception of death in Islam.
Every time I close my eyes, I see in front of me. I still can hear your voice calling out my name. And I remember all the stories you told me. I miss the time you were around. I miss the time you were around. But I'm so grateful for every moment I spent with you. 'Cause I know life won't last forever.
Today, Thursday, is the 23rd of Jamadi al-Awwal, 1442 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 18th of Day 1399 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 7th of January 2021 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. Let's bless this moment of today's special by recitation of Chapter Mulk, Verse 122. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
تبارك الذي بيده الملك وهو على كل شيء قدير.
Blessed is he in whose hand is dominion, and he is over all things competent.
الذي خلق الموت والحياة ليبلوكم أيكم أحسن عملا وهو العزيز الغفور.
He who created death and life to test you as to which of you is best indeed. And he is the exalted in might, the forgiving.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The blessed chapter opens with the significant issue of divine ownership, sovereignty, and his everlasting pure essence, which serves as the key to all discussions raised in the chapter. Within it is said that he, Allah, is bountiful and everlasting. Allah is the one in whose hand is the sovereignty of the world of existence, and Allah is omnipotent. Death employed in the sense of non-existence is not created, since creation concerns existential matters. Though we know that death is truly transference from one world to another, and in this sense, it is an existential matter which may be created.
I know that I'm not alone. What I've seen, it's been seen before, but it hurts just like a thorn, a pain I've never felt before. My heart said, just speak the truth. Mine said, don't be a fool. I need to get something off my mind. Don't let this silence be misunderstood. I don't know when my heart will take me, but I know your light will protect me from this fragile world.
We're talking about conception of death in Islam. Death is divinely willed, and when it arrives, it should be readily accepted. There should therefore be no reasoning by the bereaved as to why they have lost their loved one. Islamic scholars stress that death is unpredictable and can happen at any time, and as such, Muslims should always be prepared for the inevitable and for what is about to occur. It is but a gateway from this short but mortal existence to a life of immortality in the afterlife. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Rabbeinu Stein. In this episode, we are going to talk about how to get prepared for receiving death. At the same time, we find that those people who are, according to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, when a pious person passes away and when he or she is buried, in his or her afterlife, the experience of the dead person will be that he or she will find out that he or she has been placed in part of his or her paradise. Some sort of paradise life will be experienced. The dead person will experience some aspect or some phases of the paradise life after being buried. By contrast, we find that those people who haven't been that considerate of the experience of the religious duties, religious rituals, or being attentive to the needs of other people, they will be very much in torture, and they will be very much punished after passing away, after their death in this world. According to the sixth infallible Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, when an infidel person dies and his or her body is buried, after the tomb is covered by dust, by soil, this person will be going to experience some sort of punishment that will await, in a much greater measure for him or her on the day of judgment. Some sort of rewards that will be given to the person will be given in a smaller measure after death.
A beautiful gift for a believer. Why do we fear death? Some of the people have comprehended the reality of death and are also aware of the Islamic insight regarding death. On the other hand, they have also obtained some information regarding stations and the journey after death. However, in spite of all this, they still fear death. This fear is not due to the two reasons previously mentioned, but because they have not made available for themselves the tools and things necessary for this journey of theirs, while on the contrary, they have been paying more than necessary importance to their present lives. Instead, all that he has gathered is in the form of house, shop, land, and other things, which presently are neither capable of being changed nor transferred.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong, a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone to everything in life, but you know I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
How do we prepare for the journey of death? Presenting a gift to Allah Most High. The gift that the traveler to the hereafter should prepare to present to the divine is faith or iman that engenders love for Allah Most High. We mean here by faith a gnosis or ma'rifah that whelms the servant completely and overtakes his heart entirely until it is as if the servant actually sees Allah. Faith then becomes something vital to the heart, persistent and constant in it, to such an extent that nothing comes to the servant's mind except Allah, neither in deeply rooted thoughts nor in fleeting ones. A constant awareness and focus on Allah to the extent that not even a fleeting thought enters one's mind is the highest state of faith. As for the branches of faith, they are numerous, while its roots are three: to have belief in Allah, belief in the last day, and belief in the truthfulness of the Messenger of Allah and his Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them all.
Death should not be something that scares us so that we use it in order to worship Allah. This is where we're wrong.
When we place someone in the grave, what do we say? Allahumma hadha al-musajja bayna yadayk, abduka wabnu abdayk, nazala bik, wa anta khayru manzulan bih. Allahumma in kana musi'an fatajawaz an, wa in kana muhsinan fazid fi ihsanih. Allahumma inna la na'lamu minh illa khayra. What do we say? We say, oh Allah, this deceased, this person that has died is your abd and the son of your abd. He is now your guest, and you are the best of hosts. You are the best host, the most generous of hosts, the most merciful of hosts. And use your guest this evening. Oh Allah, take care of him. If he had bad deeds, remove his bad deeds. If he had good deeds, multiply his good deeds.
So what is it that we are truly afraid of? Imam al-Hadi salawatullahi alayhi responds, he says, a person comes to him, he says to him, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, why are people afraid of death? He says to him, why don't people drink medicine? Why don't people drink their medication? And obviously today, medication tastes okay. But back then, medication wasn't going to taste like NyQuil. It was something probably not so pleasant. So people wouldn't drink their medication because it didn't taste good. But if they know the value of the medication and they know that it will really cure them, they would drink it. So the Imam says to his companion, if people know the value of the medicine, they'll drink it because it gives them ease. Same goes for death. If people know that death is the beginning of their ease, as the beginning of their reunion with their Lord, the Almighty, the Merciful, they'll be happy, they'll be delighted.
I think death is an interesting topic to discuss about, so inshallah we continue on the next episode of today's special. Till then, fi amanillah.
Around yourself, can Can't you see this wonder spread in front of you? The clouds floating by, the sky so clear and blue. Planets in their orbits, the moon and the sun. Such perfect harmony. Let's start questioning ourselves. Isn't this proof enough for us?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio.